Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. 50 years ago, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. led a poor people's campaign for justice. Now, 50 years later, people are organizing a new poor people's campaign, a national call for moral revival. Our first guest is a leader in that movement for justice. Following him will be Congresswoman Donna Edwards of Maryland, talking about her conversations with Trump supporters as she traveled the country in her recreational vehicle to deepen her understanding of why people voted for Trump. First up is Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove with the Poor People's Campaign. He's a writer, speaker, and activist. He and his wife, Leah, founded the Rutba House, a house of hospitality where formerly homeless are welcomed into a community that eats, prays, and shares life together. Jonathan directs the School for Conversion, a nonprofit that pursues beloved community with kids in the neighborhood, through classes in North Carolina prisons, and in community-based education around the country. Jonathan is also an associate minister at the historically black St. John's Missionary Baptist Church. Jonathan is the co-author of several books, including one with the Reverend Dr. William Barber II, called The Third Reconstruction, Moral Mondays, Fusion Politics, and the Rise of a New Justice Movement. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, welcome to All Together Now.
Hey, it's good to be with you, Eleanor. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy you're here, and I've heard about this Poor People's Campaign, and I want to learn more, and I want to introduce it to some of our listeners. So let's start by talking about the Poor People's Campaign. You and 150 others were arrested in Washington, D.C. on Monday as part of a direct action coordinated with thousands of others in 30 state capitals across the country to launch the Poor People's Campaign. Tell us what happened.
Well, that's right. We were in Washington, D.C. on Monday. We were gathered together outside of the Congress and had several hundred people there gathered to launch. But really important to this campaign is that we were doing it in concert with groups all across the country. So just like you said, we had actions at 30 state capitals. And whereas 50 years ago, the Poor People's Campaign tried to bring everyone to D.C., we're really stressing that people can join this campaign wherever you are in your states, not only because we want it to be accessible, but because what we've learned is that some of the most extreme policies and the suppression of voting rights, which has caused more extremism in D.C., happens at the state level. And so those of us who were in D.C. were doing what people were doing in their state capitals. We were listening to the stories this week of women. It was Mother's Day, and so all of our testifiers were women who are impacted by poverty, systemic racism, ecological devastation, and the war economy. And so in D.C., we heard from Callie Greer, a mother from Alabama who lost her daughter because of lack of access to health care. And she died in her arms because the state of Alabama refused to expand Medicaid. Just after she spoke, a woman who was there from the Apache Reservation or the Apache Nation in Arizona shared about how corporations are drilling in Oak Flats, sacred lands of her people, and how that attack on Mother Earth is an attack on her people. We heard from a woman who is a fast food worker and who's part of the Fight for 15 and shared a heartbreaking story about how she wanted to be able to buy a car so her son could drive to work. But one day when he was riding his bicycle to work, he was hit by an automobile and killed. So it was those kind of stories that we really believe need to be front and center in our moral narrative, in the conversation we're having about what kind of country we want to be. And rather than constantly being distracted by tweets and, you know, the latest update on this or that scandal. We really want to put front and center the people who are most impacted by extreme policies. So that happened in D.C. It happened in state capitals. And to stress that that this campaign is really about saying that the country is going in the wrong direction, we took the streets outside of those legislative buildings, and hundreds of people all across the country blocked those streets and said that we need to stop, we need to turn around, and we need to pay attention to the cries of these women we had heard.
That's very moving, and there's so much that's happening in our country right now, and it's just such a mean time, meaner than I've ever seen it. What is it that's prompting you and others to start a new poor people's campaign now? Is it kind of the policies we've been seeing with Trump and the Republicans in Congress, or has this kind of been brewing for a number of years?
Well, the extremism that we see in the Trump administration, in many ways, I think, just unveils an extremism that has been brewing really in the backlash against the browning of America. There's an important pattern that we see in history, a pattern of trying to reconstruct this democracy to be a multi-ethnic democracy, and a backlash against that. So in the 19th century, when Reconstruction tried to reimagine our common life to include people who had been enslaved, we made some real progress in that area. And there were fusion coalitions in the South that black and white worked together in order to write new state constitutions, to guarantee public education, to guarantee health care at that time for people. And yet there was a huge backlash against that in the white supremacy campaigns that were not only the kind of violence of the KKK, but was really the official policy of the old plantation class in the South. And when they took back over, they called it a redemption, and indeed nationalized that through putting Supreme Court justices that overturned the Civil Rights Act of 1875, and of course passed Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. So those kind of backlashes against Reconstruction have been a pattern in this country's history. There was certainly a backlash against the Second Reconstruction or the Civil Rights Movement. And in many ways, the Southern strategy that grew out of that is what gave rise to the possibility of a campaign like the one that Donald Trump ran. So this is not just about Trump. It's really about dynamics in our common life that make democracy impossible, and yet we believe that reviving the heart of this democracy requires people to take action and put their bodies on the line to really expose what's going on, and to also appeal to the great majority of people who we know don't want this to be what our common life looks like. And so this is a broad appeal. It's not about party. It's not about any particular group. It's a broad appeal to black, white, brown, native, to Republicans, independents, Democrats, to say, you know, these are not left-right issues in terms of how we do right by our neighbors. These are moral issues. And so we're trying to change the moral narrative in the public square.
Right. I 100% support it. I also know we're kind of at a time where really since 1980, kind of wages have stagnated for many Americans. And there is kind of a feeling of that, you know, so many millions of Americans are feeling left out and left behind themselves. So many of the middle class slipping from the middle class into, you know, lower middle class or in poverty, and instead of reaching out to each other to support each other, to lift up each other, there has been, and it's been fed, I think, by the right wing Republicans, to turn on each other instead of to each other. And
that's exactly what I'm talking about in terms of the Southern strategy, pitting against one another of people who actually have quite a bit in common.
Right. Well, how do you deal with this kind of compassion fatigue, and that, you know, a lot of the middle class feeling like we've got to take care of ourselves, not do so much for people who are poor?
Well, we have to first of all expose that this narrative about the fact that, you know, people are not as well off as they were 30 years ago or 50 years ago is not because of poor people. This blaming poor people for the plight of others is really a distraction. Mm-hmm. We did a study as the really basis for this campaign and for the demands of this campaign, called "The Souls of Poor Folk: Auditing America 50 Years After the Poor People's Campaign." And what we did was look at how things have actually changed for poor people and for the country as a whole over the last 50 years. One of the things we learned in that is that 50 years ago, the average CEO in this country made 25 times the average worker. Today, the average CEO makes 256 times the average worker. And that growing disparity and the transition of many good manufacturing jobs to other places, which has meant the growth of service sector jobs for so many poor people in this country, service sector jobs that don't pay a living wage. We have millions and millions of people in this country who work over full time, sometimes work two and three jobs, and yet don't earn enough to care for their families. And so this is the shift in the economy that that some people refer to as sort of causing the, you know, the economic anxiety that that would have led to a presidency like Donald Trump's. But what we're trying to say is that it's actually the result of a highly funded effort, as you were saying, by extremists on the extreme right, folks like the Koch brothers and others, who've invested in candidates who intentionally pit people against one another and have convinced so many white people, especially in the South and the Rust Belt, that their plight is the result of the government giving too much money to other people, when it's just not true. And so what we're trying to do is to expose that lie. One of the important things, you know, I mentioned that Callie Greer shared her story on Monday in D.C. of her daughter dying, her African-American daughter dying, because Alabama didn't extend Medicaid. In many ways, the narrative that the majority of the legislature in Alabama has tried to tell for years now is that, you know, black people in Alabama are taking white people's money. But as a matter of fact, Alabama's refusal to expand Medicaid impacted more white people, poor white people, than it did black folks. And so, you know, in so many ways, when people say, is it race or is it class, this campaign is insisting, yes, it's both. We have to have systemic racism and systemic poverty alongside one another and refuse to be divided.
Right. And you're so right about that. And it amazes me that we have, the right wing has successfully gotten middle class people to blame the poor for, so-called costing us so much money. But when you actually look at the federal budget, where is the money going? It's going to this $1.5 trillion tax break to the very wealthy and to big business, as well as the huge amount that we spend every year on our military, which largely goes to the weapons companies. So
that's right. To those private. Meanwhile, veterans are sleeping on the street. A lot of veterans in this campaign. People who become homeless. People who don't have health care, even though they've risked their lives to defend this country.
Right. So I appreciate you helping to set the record straight and tell people what's really going on. And it also amazes me that so many people in politics who talk about values and morality are actually against progressive policies. So a lot of the religious right will talk about family values, and yet they vote for people who vote against things that would help families, like raising the minimum wage or paid family leave, even health care for children now where they're trying to roll back the CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Plan.
That's right.
So what do you have to say to people like that on the religious right who claim to be talking about family values but then vote in a way that undermines families?
Oh, this is an incredibly important point for me because I'm a Baptist preacher in North Carolina. My people have been targeted by the extreme right who tried to convince us that we vote our values when we ask the single question about abortion or increasingly about religious liberty being a kind of ruse for, again, trying to split people, trying to split religious folk apart from the gay and lesbian and transgender communities. So this is very much a part of the Southern strategy you know, this is an important thing that Nancy McLean lays out in her book, Democracy in Chains, that the folks who laid out this plan, this long-term plan to really redefine liberty as freedom from the government, and to convince people that if the government tries to do anything, they're taking money from you. That campaign, which is essentially a libertarian campaign, tried for a while to make that shift in public life without religious folks. And what they realized was they couldn't do it. And so in the 80s, they began heavily investing in creating these NGOs and nonprofit organizations and so-called ministries and radio stations and TV stations to really target the faith community, the Christian faith community, and especially white Christians, and to use the old dog whistles of race, but to associate them with their religious convictions. That's an incredible corruption of the gospel that I'm called to preach. Because if Jesus said anything, he said what he said in his first sermon, that he was called to preach good news to the poor. And if Jesus did anything, he set up free health clinics everywhere he went. So these what you were calling, you know, pro-family policies, you know, policies that make it easier for families to take care of one another and to stay together and survive in this society, they are indeed being undercut by the very people who claim to be for family values. And so this Poor People's Campaign is explicitly a national call for moral revival, because we refuse to let the extremists who speak in the name of Jesus, or you know, sometimes religious extremists who speak in the name of some other tradition, to have the say about what morality and faithfulness looks like in public life. And so the national call for moral revival is really a wake-up call for people to see how we've been duped, how we've been deceived, and to reclaim the heart of our traditions.
I think that's fabulous. And I know another ruse being used to try and get people to stop funding programs for the poor is to say, well, you know, we tried that in the 1960s and 70s, the whole war against poverty with President Johnson, and people saying, well, see, we tried that, it cost a lot of money and it didn't work. But actually, if you look at the data, it did work. And the program particularly helping, you know, increasing Social Security, which would provide our seniors to be able to live in dignity. We really brought down the rates of poverty among seniors. And also the food stamp program really helped to alleviate a lot of hunger in America. So I think there's a real misunderstanding about what can be done, that we actually can alleviate most of the problems of poverty. What do you have
to
say?
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, what do you say to people who say, well, we tried that and it didn't work?
Well, we say that we didn't lose the war on poverty. We gave up the field. And that was a large part of this transition to imagining liberty as freedom from government. Report on 50 years after the Kerner Commission came out this year, and on issue after issue, this is exactly what they say, that that these programs did work. Marion Wright Edelman with the Children's Defense Fund was the main policy advisor on the original Four People's Campaign. She's advising us still, and she says there are 50 pieces of legislation that she can point to over the past 50 years that essentially advanced one or another of the kinds of things that the original Poor People's Campaign was asking for. Every one of them has been fought for, and many of them are either under attack or have already been rescinded. But one after another, those programs reduced child poverty. They reduced as you were saying, poverty for elderly folks. They reduced the likelihood of people dying. And yet we have good research that says 250,000 people a year in the wealthiest country in the history of the world die from low wealth, not from cancer or from heart disease or from any other preventable sort of disorder, but from simply being poor. And this Poor People's Campaign is about saying that that's a reality that's been swept under the rug, that we've been, you know, distracted and pushed away from. And we're insisting that whoever claims to represent us in our state capitals or in Washington, D.C., have to answer, what are we doing about that reality?
Right, exactly. Well, and then the other attack I hear on doing things for the poor is to say, well, it costs too much money and we can't afford it. And, you know, I just look at the federal budget and go, you know, really, let's look at the facts here. We are the wealthiest country in the history of the world. If we took a fraction of the tax benefits that go just to the oil companies alone, to the tune of billions of dollars every year, and redirected that, we could really eliminate poverty in America. So this is all, to me, eminently doable. We could do it within a generation. We know a lot of the policies and programs that do work. We have the money. We're just right now, in my view, with a Republican Congress and president running pell-mell in the wrong direction and giving too much money and subsidies and tax breaks to the very wealthy and the big business instead of directing it towards the poor and middle class, when just look at the treasure that each child is. And, you know, who knows what Einstein is in there, but is, you know, like this woman who lost her child, who knows what that child could have grown up and been a scientist and helped us cure cancer. So the national genius that's wasted because we're not doing what Jesus directed us to do, which is love your neighbor as yourself.
That's right. Go in my tradition, we'd say, go ahead and preach.
Well, you're the preacher here. I'm learning from you here. And I am eager to know, like, what are the specific demands on the Poor People's Campaign? What would you like to see come out of it?
Thanks for asking. Well, you're absolutely right that we know the kinds of things that work. And part of what we know is that there's not any one single thing that's going to change everything. So this is not a campaign for one particular bill or one particular, this is an intersectional campaign that recognizes that we need a whole agenda, and we need a movement that's going to create the kind of representation that pursues that agenda. But we do want to be specific. And so the campaign has outlined demands that cover everything from, you know, guaranteed health care for people in this country, a guaranteed free public education that's constitutional and diverse. We're talking about, living wages in every state and a federal living wage. We're talking about actions that would create just immigration reform, that would really guarantee voting rights for everyone in this country, automatic registration at 18 years old. And so under those categories of systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, and the war economy, we've laid out very specific demands, and people can look at those at the website, poorpeoplescampaign.org. But what you were saying earlier about the issue of how do we pay for it, I think that's one of the reasons that we have to look at the war economy. Mm-hmm. This current administration has proposed ballooning a defense budget that is already grossly out of proportion to everything else that the government spends money on. And there are so many reports about the waste that goes on. And like you were saying, in many ways, our defense budget is a form of kickbacks to the contractors and the companies that are so heavily invested in these extreme candidates. I think there was just a report today that the Defense Department can't account for some $21 trillion that have just gone missing. They're not sure, which program it got spent on. Think about what the kind of money that just gets wasted in these programs could do if it were invested in education, if we're invested in infrastructure development, if it were invested in the possibility of health care for everyone in this country. I mean, one of the things that the Affordable Care Act, which was so demonized by the extreme right for so long and which is still under attack, while it's imperfect and only covered about half of the people who were uninsured in the end, one of the things we learned just from the rollout of the Affordable Care Act in the last several years is that extending health insurance to a half of the people who were uninsured cut the number of bankruptcies in this country in half. And so we know that one of the things that bankrupts people in our society is the exorbitant cost of health care. And the fact that, any of us are just one diagnosis away from having all of our wealth sucked up into this healthcare industry. So there's one very specific thing that could impact anyone. It doesn't matter your race, creed, or class. If you get cancer tomorrow, nobody has enough money in their pocket or in the bank to cover everything it's going to cost. So these are the kinds of policies that we want to build a will to address. And yet, as I was saying, there's no single bill or no single platform even right now that would address all of these things. And so we see the essential work as building a movement that will create the kind of conversation and the kind of politicians who could pursue a moral agenda in our people's houses.
That sounds great. And we just have 1 minute left, but I'm eager to know, what gives you the hope that this campaign can succeed, particularly now in this time of Trump and meanness and kind of attacks on people of color and of attacks on the poor even? Why do you think this is going to work now?
Well, when we look at history, we see that every movement for justice has always been resisted by those in power, by those who've benefited from injustice. And yet every step forward that this country has made seemed impossible when people started it. So whether it was abolishing slavery or, winning women's suffrage or the labor laws that were developed early in the 20th century, all of those things seemed impossible when people began to organize. And yet I'm a preacher again. I believe the psalm that says the stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. If we're going to reconstruct America, I believe the people who've been rejected are the people who need to be the basis of that movement. And that's what this Poor People's Campaign is about. So that's what gives me hope.
Fantastic. Well, that's all the time we have. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, thank you so much for being on All Together Now and for all your great work.